I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My first guest today is Wes Moore. He's the host of Future City here on WYPR. He heads up Robin Hood, an anti-poverty organization in New York. He's also an Army combat veteran and the best-selling author of several books, including The Other Wes Moore. When he was 3 years old, Wes Moore's father died unexpectedly. His mother, Joy Thomas Moore, has written a book about being present for your kids, which she calls the secret sauce of parenting. It's called The Power of Presence. Be a voice in your child's ear even when you're not with them. Wes Moore and Joy Thomas Moore join me to talk politics, policy, family, and the future when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is Wes Moore. He's a best-selling author and social entrepreneur. He is the CEO of a New York-based organization called Robin Hood, which works on anti-poverty initiatives. He's the author of several books, including two New York Times bestsellers, The Other Wes Moore and The Work, Searching for a Life That Matters. And he is the host, of course, of Future City, which airs here on WYPR on the third Wednesday of the month, right after Midday. Wes Moore is speaking at an event tonight at the Parkway Theater in Baltimore. That's a benefit for WYPR. By the way, that event is sold out. But if you'd like to have a conversation with Wes Moore this afternoon, you are welcome to join it. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming as well on the WYPR Facebook page. Good to see you, sir.
It is great to be here with you, Tom. Thank you so much.
So you're going to talk about this evening, we'll give folks a little primer about this, about the human consequences of policy.
Yeah.
But policy isn't necessarily relegated only to the political realm. It's not just government, is it? Policy is a more encompassing term.
That's exactly right. I mean, policy is how we think about all the larger structures that help to dictate and to think about all of our lives. And if you think about every single one of us, everything that we're in right now is a result of either good policies or bad policies. Right. Everything that exists in our entire ecosystem is exclusively focused on how we think about the policies that help to make it happen, the policies that either help to make our lives easier or the policies that are repeatedly making our lives more difficult. And so really, how do we think about that holistically when it comes to the future of our city and our state and our country and how we're thinking about the world going forward? But then also being able to think about what is our role as individuals to be able to help to structure, to be able to help to bring these policies to bear, because it's not simply our job just to be on the receiving end.
Yeah, and that's a really good question to pose, because often we hear people posing the question of the function of government.
Yeah.
What is the role of government? And, you know, the political left and political right have somewhat different perspectives on that. That, yeah. You know, people on the right tend to think government is one of those things that we need to attenuate to the extent that we can. We need a limited amount. They talk about it in terms of quantity,
right.
You know, and on the left, it's saying, well, government can be a force for good, and et cetera. And we think about this as the role of the government,
yeah.
But we don't think about it as our role in the government.
That's right. And we think about it in almost like this binary thing. Is government good or is government bad? You know, government is everything that we do. Government is, you know, government is the roads that we're driving on. It's the air that we're breathing. It's the water that we're drinking. It's the schools that we attend. It's the buildings that we exist in, right? Government is how exactly can we think smartly about the systems that we have in place that are helping to navigate the way that we live our lives. And you know, when we talk about what is the role of government and smaller government or bigger government and that kind of thing, you know, oftentimes it does miss a larger point about we should be thinking about how and what structures and ways can government help to build proper infrastructure around the way that we live. You know, there is no one has the budget that government has. Nobody has the bully pulpit that government has. And so our role in terms of, you know, what is our place in this democracy is to really be active in it. And that it doesn't just start and stop with who we elect or who we, you know, if we choose to vote or if we choose to put a person in office. But then it's about how do we repeatedly hold people accountable? How do we repeatedly present best options and best alternatives? How are we repeatedly, when things aren't working for us, are we finding unique and powerful ways to be able to express that dissatisfaction and then hold people to a greater standard to be able to solve for it?
And of course, the data that we use, that we can access to make those kinds of decisions, gets more complicated by the minute because there's so much information, disinformation, misinformation, yeah. spun information. It's really difficult to even know the set of facts that everybody's working with. I was just frankly appalled today to read in the Wall Street Journal an editorial by Mike Pompeo, who's the Secretary yeah. of State. And he, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this, it's about Khashoggi and Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was killed in Turkey in the Saudi consulate there. And he repeats, the Secretary of State repeats some memes about the Obama administration that have long been disproven, long been established as, inaccurate. Yeah. And here they are being repeated on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. It's like, how do we work our way through the morass and the media literacy that it takes everybody, that's incumbent upon everybody to have, not just citizens, but people actually running the government itself.
It's amazing how we are dealing with this assault on facts, right now, where this idea that facts are being readily disputed and discredited. And so people really are trying to search for, well, what is the thing that can actually, that I can hold on to that I know is true, that I know that is real. And it's interesting because, I have really more of a quantitative mind than a qualitative mind. Like, I love data and I love numbers and I love stats. At Robinhood, there's one of our core values is that we're data driven and heart led. And I very much feel that kind of embodies how I view the world. I also have a real frustration with statistics as well, though, because I know statistics can be manipulated. I know that, statistics is simply a game of inputs and outputs, right? You could tell me something, right now, Tom, that could be absolutely factual and true. Someone could walk in here 5 minutes from now and tell me a stat that completely discredits your stat, and theirs could be true, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's a study proving everything.
Right. And it simply depends on what inputs that we're willing to incorporate into that study that then determine the outputs. And I remember, when I was writing my first book, it made me think about something because my editor said something to me that I won't forget. And he said, we were talking about how exactly to tell the story of these two boys and this and that. And he said, and I told him, I was like, maybe I should do what are the 10 steps that every parent should do or the 10 steps that every, mentor should do. And he said to me, he said, listen, Wes, that's really interesting and all, but I'm going to be honest with you. No one wants to read a parenting book by a 30-year-old with no children.
Yeah. there's a credibility gap there.
There's a credibility gap there. And I was thinking, that's actually a good point. And he said to me, tell us the stories. And he said, because, statistics, if you tell someone a stat, their eyes eventually will gloss over and they'll forget. But if you tap into a person's humanity, they'll never forget what you're trying to tell them. And I thought about that in context of where we are right now, where every piece in the history of this country, every piece of good legislation or bad legislation was first driven by a narrative change, right? I mean, where narrative is the leading indicator. Policy is the lagging indicator, and there's a great line in The American President where they say, they tell us to be afraid of it and they tell us who to blame for it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you win elections.
Yeah.
And we have to do a better job of controlling the narrative. And it's a narrative that comes and attacks us from so many different places in so many different directions, where eventually we have a population that's just totally spun up and not sure what's up and what's down. Who should we fight for? Who should we be scared of? And why? And then what policies then are we putting in place or being done right under our noses that are, quote unquote, protecting us from that threat? When we're talking about how the data matters in all this and how truth matters in all of this, the data is going to be an important reflection of how we get to a truth, right? The data, the numbers, that will help us to determine and help to provide an azimuth on how we get to a place of truth and honesty. However, making sure that we never forget the heart-led part, making sure that we never forget the humanity in this, making sure that we never forget the human touch and the exposure and the connection that then makes that data meaningful and that makes that data sticky.
And so often the data is bifurcated.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who believe one set of who have one perspective or believe perhaps one set of facts, and other people who have a completely different perspective and another set of facts. I mean, the people who are now waiting in Tijuana to come in and apply for asylum in the United States are either a marauding band of criminals who need to be kept out with tear gas and razor wire, or they are these helpless people who are fleeing horrible violence and degradation in their home countries, who are in need of a welcoming embrace from the greatest country on earth. How do you parse through that?
Yeah.
I mean, because the president is pounding away on one narrative, and then we have other people pounding away on another narrative, and it just seems it's almost impossible to imagine those two narratives merging and those two people understanding that, you know, immigration law is important and that we've got to have, you know, rules about how people enter the country, but compassion and love and humanity is important as well.
Yeah, and the fact that no matter where you land, you're going to find validators. Right, you're going to find people who will tell you that what you think is absolutely right, and in fact, let me give you more ammunition to continue to push your belief. And it's interesting because if you watch simple things like, what people watch on television, what they listen to, who they follow on Twitter,
Instagram,
mm-hmm. you can get a pretty good sense as to where a person is. As to where a person is politically, about what they're thinking about, because oftentimes we're not asking for information, we're asking for validation in the way that we think and in the way we process information for someone smart to tell me that I'm smart and that I'm correct. And when I think about, so you take that issue, you take, you know, a collection of different issues that are being debated, right now, issues of immigration, the assault right now on the LGBTQ community, the assault on, really any form of minority that we have inside this country right now. Part of the most powerful ways that we can be able to make ourselves, to really fortify ourselves around it and to educate ourselves around it, is also gaining a specific level of exposure and making it personal. I think about it from a very personal perspective. So for example, Tom, I got very involved in the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And, I spent...
And we remind folks that you are a combat veteran in the U.S. Army.
Yes, so I'm combat veteran in the U.S. Army. And when I first joined the Army, I was 17 years old. And to be very honest, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the law of the land. But I didn't think anything of it because it didn't impact me. Right. I was like, fine, there's a ban on homosexuals and they don't ask me and I don't say anything. But it doesn't impact me. So whatever. Right. It wasn't a thing I spent a whole lot of time on. I had a mentor when I was 13 years old, when I first got sent away to military school. And that was not a very good or pleasant experience when I first got sent away. But this man helped to make sense of the entire process for me. One of some of my first days there, he told me that he was going to be my big brother, and he turned out becoming more than just my big brother at the school. He really became my big brother. I mean, this is a person who, when I first enlisted in the Army right out of high school, he was one of the first people I called because I knew he was an Army officer and I knew I wanted to make him proud. When I first got commissioned, he was sitting right there in the front row, sitting right next to my mom, pinning a bar on my shoulder. When I got married, he was standing right to my left. He means everything to me. And I knew he was in the Army, and he got out of the Army, and I thought he got out of the Army because his time had elapsed. Until I was actually trying to set him up with one of my wife's friends, and he wasn't calling her. And I knew she thought he was cute, and he said she was trying. I was like, this is great. Like, why aren't you calling her? And then I finally called him up, and I said, listen, man, you're embarrassing me. Why don't you give her a call? And he explained to me why he wasn't going to call her. And that was the conversation in which he came out to me. And he told me that he was leaving, that the reason that he left the military wasn't because his time ran out, was because he had the audacity of telling his commanding officer his truth. And the Army had him out in 6 weeks. I had soldiers who put their spouses in the hospital, and it took me 6 months to get them out. And he was out of the Army in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And if anyone can make a singular argument to me as to somehow why having him in the military was making our country less safe, I'm listening. And there is not a single argument that could come in. And that, in fact, my argument is, and where I fall, and I won't be moved on it, is our country became less safe the moment we said he could not serve in uniform. This is a man who I would trust.
And the talent pool that we lost.
That's exactly right. I would trust my children under his command. He's that good a leader. And he means that much to me. And so I got very involved in the repeal for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I celebrated as loud as anybody when that law was abolished for good. And it wasn't something that, again, that when I first joined the military, that I had a natural connection to, until I did. And I think part of the thing that we have to be able to do is put ourselves in a space where we can understand our own privilege, make ourselves a little bit uncomfortable, understand the conditions and the situations that people are either running from or running to, and why. And that, I think, is the best way for us to have that natural sense and connection to humanity and where we could and should fall on different issues. I'm a person who believes deeply that when you look at the situation, are you always going to have anomalies? Are you always going to have, exceptions? Of course you will. We don't make policies based on that. We make policies based on what is going to bring us back to the greater humanity and the greater intent of this country's founding. That we are that place that people come to, that people, when you're providing shelter, providing support, providing pathways that all of our families at some point in our nation's history benefited from, every one of us. And so I think part of the challenge right now is that, we have a larger narrative that is cutting people off. We have larger frameworks that are telling people that's okay because your isolation should be validated. And we're doing it because there is a lack of appreciation for the long-term consequence, not just for the true consequence in our country, but for the moral consequence of this country.
Wes Moore is the CEO of the New York-based Robinhood. That's one of the largest anti-poverty organizations in the country. He hosts WIPR's Future City. He is a best-selling author. One of his books, of course, The Other Wes Moore. We're going to be joined a little bit later by Wes's mom, who will talk about her latest book as well. But we are going to take a quick break now. And when you come back, if you'd like to join our conversation with Wes Moore, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. We are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. You can catch us there. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Thanks, Matt. Welcome back indeed to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program with Governor Larry Hogan's historic victory over former NAACP President Ben Jealous, a conversation about the future of the Democratic Party in Maryland. On Saturday, Democrats will gather to hold a vote for the next state party chair. The incumbent chair, Kathleen Matthews, is being challenged by former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Maya Rocky Moore Cummings. They'll both join me here in Studio A, and we'll talk about their visions for the future of the party in Maryland and beyond. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here tomorrow as well with a review of the new production of Elf, the musical, at the Olney Theater Center. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Wes Moore. Among many accomplishments, he's a best-selling author of several books, including The Other Wes Moore. And coming up a little later, Wes Moore's mom, Joy Thomas Moore, will join us as well. She's also an author. Her new book is called The Power of Presence: Be a Voice in Your Child's Ear, Even When You're Not With Them. Joy Moore will, in fact, be with her child and me and you in just a little bit. You are welcome to join us and be part of our conversation right now. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. If you want to send me a tweet and follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Your show that you host here on WIPR Future City is premised on finding paradigms, finding examples of cities and programs that are really working well, and perhaps we can adopt them here in Baltimore and around the country. when it comes to, and I want to talk a little bit about Robinhood, and then we're going to go to the phones.
Yeah.
Robinhood works on anti-poverty stuff. What, in your experience, has been the best practices when it comes to alleviating poverty, which I think everybody can agree is often very much at the root of all sorts of other problems? When we talk about violence in cities, when we talk about education levels, when we talk about malnutrition and health, it's premised in people not having adequate resources to live comfortably.
Absolutely. And also just how integrated so many of those challenges are, right? You know, it's when I first went to Robinhood, you know, Robinhood is one of the largest poverty fighting organizations in America. Over the course of Robinhood has dispersed over $3 billion into this work, and you know, we have over.
So you are giving grants to organizations who are doing work in the poverty space.
Correct. That's exactly right. Amongst you know, other things as well, but absolutely. So it's giving grants to organizations that are doing really interesting and good and innovative work inside this space. And we have over 240 organizations that we fund. And I've had a chance to visit and meet with all the leaders and all the different organizations, every single one of them. And I tell you, one of the most fascinating things that I have found was the thing that the organization says they do, that's not the thing they're spending the most time on, right? So the organizations that we work on education, and I speak with them and I go visit them and I see them. And you know what they talk to me most about? Mental health. The people who work in housing, you know what they talk to me most about? Transportation. The people who work in our job training programs that we fund, you know what they spend the most time talking about? Criminal justice reform. So the fascinating thing is, I think these organizations understand a larger dynamic and a larger complication is the fact that the way we've constructed problem solving is not the way people live. The way we think about government,
the silos, the transportation silo, the criminal justice silo. Yeah.
You know, I have a friend who says this. He's like, you know, it's like driving on, you know, the JFX, and you get into an accident, right? And you get rushed to the emergency room, and then you're inside the emergency room and you're beat up bad. I mean, you got in a really bad accident, and as you're sitting there and they're trying to save your life, an orthopedic surgeon walks in and says, "Oh, sorry, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. This is not me." You know, it's like, but I need a doctor who can help me right now with all the different things that are going on with me. But we don't fund that way. We don't structure that way. Government isn't built that way. And so really the thing that we need to do, and part of the thing I think we pride ourselves on at Robinhood, is how do you think holistically about a holistic problem? You know, what we have in so many communities, we have essentially a holistic breakdown. And the only way you can address that is a holistic buildup. And to be able to really think humanly and critically and in a data-driven fashion about what's the best way to create systems and structures when for many people, those systems and structures have been completely dismantled and a long time ago.
The premise of the story of Robin Hood, which everybody knows, is steal from the rich, give to the poor. Yeah. There is a big conversation about the obligation of those of us with resources. Yeah. Some of us have lots and lots of resources, mm-hmm. the 0.001%. Many of the rest of us have, you know, certainly adequate resources. What is the obligation of people who are haves to the people who are have-nots? And is that, that's not just a government issue.
Correct.
It's a moral issue. It's an issue of values. How do you frame that conversation with the people that you talk to and in your own mind?
I think that it's important for people who, you know, first, I think it's important to be honest about, you know, when especially those of us who are the haves, about how those haves were derived. You know, everybody knows we all work hard. We all worked hard to be able to accomplish what we accomplished. We get that, and that should be baked in and doesn't have to be continually repeated. But at the same time, we also have to understand the structures and systems that have been put in place that made that possible. You know, one of the things that I think about even within, you know, my own story is oftentimes when people talk about my trajectory and my journey, you know, there's a sense of, oh, he came from this and now he is here. And they use this almost as a justification for the balance that, you know, my life wasn't the things that were put in place or not put in place and how it's about individual responsibility and et cetera. Fine. But it does not in any way, shape, or form. A, it doesn't talk about a whole story. And B, that's the wrong takeaway. Because this should not be a story of exceptionalism. This should really be a story about why exceptionalism is even necessary and why we have conversations about exceptionalism. And so when I think about the conversation about the haves and the have-nots, you know, first, you know, I think we have to be honest about the fact that for so many of the haves is because there were things that have been put in place that made those haves even available, that made them even there, and how thin that line is between our life and someone else's life who is not benefiting in the same way. The second thing and the second conversation I think that that all of us as the haves need to have as well is that our haves cannot simply stop at philanthropy. You know, our give back should not simply be, well, I give to X organization or I write a check to Y organization. So therefore, I feel like that's me paying my debt and respect and I'm done, right? We also have to think about what are the other tools and assets that we have in our capacity to be able to make real change? What are the other things that we can do and the other things that we can utilize that we can actually push to make life better? Because frankly, this is not just a selfless conversation. This is a selfish conversation. If you really want to live in a community that is safe and thriving and prosperous, you better make sure that everybody in that community feels like it is safe and thriving and prosperous. If you want to live in a community where your children feel embraced and where you feel like they have a greater hope for their future than you had for yours, you had better make sure that everybody in that community feels embraced and feel like their children have a better hope for their future than that individual has for their own. Mm-hmm. Because if people do not feel a vested interest and feel like everyone has a vested interest in their future, then the type of future that we're all talking about, this future of isolation, this future of nihilism, is not one that any one of us want to embrace.
And I think so many folks on the have side of the ledger have an impulse to wall themselves off.
Yes.
I mean, Mr. Trump isn't the only one who's talking about building walls. I mean, the whole notion of a gated community,
right,
you know, is all, and the whole notion of redlining, the whole notion of covenants in communities that Baltimore was a world leader in back
right.
in the day. You know, it's just if the impulse is to wall yourself off, as opposed to get involved. I mean, you know, the statistics, and you and I have talked about this a million times, the life expectancy for a kid born in Harlem Park tomorrow and born in Roland Park is 20 years difference.
20 years.
That's crazy. That's just crazy.
That's right.
You know? Let's go to the phones. Jacob in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Wes Moore.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me on, and it's nice to talk to you. I just got a question about how do you come to your first principles on how you make your decisions on right and wrong?
Mm. Wow, that's a great question, Jacob. That's a deep question too.
You know, I tried to be.
where are you from? Where in Baltimore?
I'm actually driving through. I drive all the time, so I like to listen to interesting conversations. I think
an
interesting point of view. So I just kind of try to figure things out. I mean, me myself, I'm a Christian, so I get things from a biblical point of view.
Yep.
How I make my decisions based on first principles of things that I know to be true.
Yeah.
I was just wondering how you, like, I know you were talking about the LGBT, community.
Yeah.
And I accept, I imagine you're pretty approving of the lifestyle and such. So I was just wondering how you came to that. It's humane to accept, which I would think, the Bible would be, is not a good lifestyle to live, and it's very dangerous for individuals to live in such a lifestyle. How you come to the conclusion that it's morally a good thing to promote and advocate for. I'm just, not being judgmental. I just want to know how you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you bringing that up, Jacob. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and really appreciate the question, Jacob. And it's interesting because I find myself coming from a perspective kind of very similar where, I find myself, I'm a very, both, religious and spiritual person. My grandfather was actually the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. He's actually got a really interesting history where he was the first one in our family actually born in this country. He was born down in South Carolina. And when he was just a toddler, the Ku Klux Klan ran our family, not just out of South Carolina, but ran us out of this country. My great grandfather was a minister, and was very vocal, and the Ku Klux Klan didn't like that for a vocal black minister in South Carolina. When my family moved back to Jamaica, My grandfather,
which is where your mom was
which
born.
Which is where my mom was born.
Right.
The majority of my family always vowed to never come back to this country. And my grandfather always vowed that he would. And eventually he came back and went to school here and then eventually brought his family, and that included my mother, who when she was about 5 years old came back to the United States. And I think about it actually, and I think about your question, Jacob, actually in reflection of that, because I think that, you know, my grandfather, who was, you know, one of the most pious and beautiful and religious people you'll ever meet, was also someone who saw humanity at its ugliest at times. And the way that he approached his work was understanding this idea that as a Christian, and what he imposed and what he willed and imposed on us was that as a Christian, our job is to understand that if we are all God's children, then by definition we're brothers and sisters. By definition, if we're all God's children. And that the only thing that God asks us for us to do is to act like it. You know, if you think about Jesus, you know, when Jesus was persecuted, who was he persecuted with? He was persecuted with thieves. He was persecuted with criminals. And, you know, one of the things that Jesus did was that he washed the feet of criminals. You know, he went to visit lepers. And so the idea that there is any of us that are better than others, my personal belief is not only not accurate, it's also just it contradicts the beliefs and it contradicts the, you know, my personal relationship with the God that I love and the God that I trust. Where I feel like, you know, so many times I feel like, you know, I am othered by other people. And the only thing that I ask of them who will judge me before they know me is to give me a chance. And so how can I ask that of other people and I not be willing to turn around and give that to somebody else?
And of course, the query that Jacob raises about how you come to this moral judgment on your own,
yeah,
for your personal moral compass, is then one step, 10 step, 30 steps removed from how we come to a collective consensus.
Correct.
About how to run the world and, yeah, how to run our government and run our society. And the Supreme Court, for example, when it comes to marriage equality, has decided that. And 10 years ago, it seemed unlikely that they would ever decide that. And
then
something happened in the body politic to allow marriage equality to be literally the law of the land. Yeah,
yeah.
What fascinates me about that argument in particular is why people don't see it as the right of people to live the way they want to live. I mean, yeah, there are cricket teams in India and Pakistan and London, and I don't care whether they win or lose, you know? And I don't care who anybody sleeps with.
Right.
There's stuff I care a lot about, you know? The Ravens, the Orioles, now that's it. But I just don't care who people sleep with.
Yeah.
All right, we got to take a little break.
But what you care about there is their humanity.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why I think we also approach it, particularly when it's things that, you know, don't impact us. But the thing that I do care about is that their humanity be warranted and that their humanity be, you know, be uplifted and justified the same way that we ask the same that people do that of us.
Wes Moore, he's a best-selling author and the CEO of the New York-based Robin Hood. That's an anti-poverty organization. He's giving a talk tonight at the Parkway Theater here in Baltimore about the real life consequences of poor public policies. That talk is sold out. His first book, The Other Wes Moore, has been optioned by executive producer Oprah Winfrey and HBO. So it's going to be made into a movie. That's great.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll have more with Wes Moore. Plus, Wes Moore's mother, the author Joy Thomas Moore, will join us. Her new book is called The Power of Presence. Be a voice in your child's ear, even when you're not with them. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Thanks, Matt, and welcome back. It is midday. I'm Tom Hall. Wes Moore is with me here in Studio A. He's the CEO of the New York-based Robin Hood. It's an anti-poverty organization. He's written a whole bunch of books, and he hosts WIPR's Future City. And now we are delighted to welcome Wes's mother, Joy Thomas Moore. She is the president and CEO of JWS Media Consulting, and she worked for many years with the Annie E. Casey Foundation here in Baltimore. Early in her career, she worked in radio and TV, and she won a Peabody Award. She joins us from Little Rock, Arkansas, where she's doing an event around her new book, The Power of Presence: Be a Voice in Your Child's Ear, Even When You're Not With Them. Mrs. Moore, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak to you. And hi, Wes.
Hey, Mama.
You know, Ms. Moore, last week on Wednesday, my mom was on the show, and we were talking about Thanksgiving cooking and dinners and traditions, and now Wes's mom. This is great. We have this midday with the moms thing going here, and we're very, very excited about it. So your book, Mrs. Moore, which is really, you have an amazing life story. Your son told some of it when he wrote The Other Wes Moore and his other book. But your amazing life story, you've turned this into, you've glean some of the lessons that you've learned from your life heretofore and put it in this book. Give people the sort of snapshot version. We talked a little bit about you earlier in the show. You were born in Jamaica. You came here when you were 5 years old. And then you and Wes's dad, fill us in the general outlines of the story for folks who aren't familiar with it.
Well, actually, I was working in radio when I met his dad. And we were working together. I was actually his researcher in public affairs, and we worked together and, you know, obviously worked well together, and then eventually, you know, fell in love and we got married. And he was a news director. He was more an anchor as I was, you know, working in the public affairs space. And then 5 years after we got married, he got sick. Literally in 24 hours, he died of an acute infection in his esophagus. And so at that point, I was a 32-year-old widow with three kids. By then, I had Wes, who was almost four, and his older sister, who was from my first marriage, who was 10, and then the baby, who was about 20 months. So, you know, I sort of at that point fell into what you were just talking about, sort of this area of poverty, because we went from a, you know, a tandem family to someone who was riding a unicycle. And I so I was able to, with the help of a lot of people, and this is what I really try to stress in the book, you know, being a single parent is not something that you can do alone. And it's something I was fortunate. I had friends, I had family, and but there's so many people who don't, and those are the ones who are mired in poverty. And when you're mired in poverty, your family cannot thrive. So, so that's why I wrote the book. And I wanted, and something that you said earlier, Wes, about exceptionalism, I included 15 other stories besides our story because I did not want it to seem like, okay, this was what happened to us was something that was unique.
Right.
You know, what it is that, and Wes brilliantly says it in his foreword, that the, you know, single moms are not America's burden, but the backbone of America. And once we realize that and we give the support that they need, we can have a stronger nation.
You write that presence is the secret sauce of parenting, and you divide the book into the discussion of things like presence of mind, presence of heart, presence of faith, presence of courage. What about presence? What is presence in a general sense, and why is it the secret sauce?
Presence is sort of is being able to transmit those values, tools, and tips to your children in a way that even when you're not physically in their presence, they will be able to rely on them to really judge how they will then rule their own lives. And I was really curious when I was listening earlier to Jacob's question, you know, the whole notion of, you know, how do you do right? How do you, you know, make that decision between right and wrong? That's what presence is. It's helping that child make those decisions, make those choices. You know, I think in the, if there was a comparison between the other Wes Moore and what I've written as presence, mine is sort of the prequel to the other Wes Moore, because that's where you get your guidance from your parents. which will carry you through for the rest of your life.
And Wes, you write in the foreword of your mom's book about many myths that people have, misconceptions about single parenting and single parent households. Half of all kids growing up in the United States grow up in single parent households. And in communities of color, that's an even higher amount. And 90% of those single parent households are headed by women.
That's right. And you know, we will never be able to fully thank our women for being able to hold down our community for as long as we've asked them to hold them down. You know, really for hundreds of years. This is not even a new phenomenon. And I remember I once ended up doing Meet the Press, and Chuck Todd was asking me a question where he mentioned the Moynihan Report, and this was a report that came out, I believe, in 1966, where Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan put together this report talking about African Americans growing up in single parent households. And he said to me, when the Moynihan Report was done, the rate was around 50%, a little less than 50% for African American children growing up in single parent households. And in the report, it talked about this idea that we will never be able to fully fulfill the promise of these kids as long as they're growing up in single parent households. Chuck's question to me then was, he said, Wes, the number is now close to 70%. And he said, and this was right after everything happened with Freddie Gray, and he said to me, is what we're watching in Baltimore right now, is this the destruction of the family? And my answer to him was, you know, you can't talk about this without understanding the role the family does play, and two-parent households and supportive households, they do matter, right? Statistically, anecdotally, et cetera. However, what we're watching is not necessarily the breakdown of family. What we're watching is the breakdown of the definition of family. Because there's this idea that because a child is not born of you, that they are not your responsibility. And I think that our story, my mom's story, my story, is just a great example of how the definition of family continued to evolve. The definition of family continued to change, where even though my father was not physically present, his ideals, his thoughts, his intent through my mom, through my uncles, through my grandparents, through my mentors and coaches and ministers, it was felt, it was understood. And so how do we go about changing, not just the structure of family, but how do we go about changing the definition of family is, I think, a place that we've got to get to.
Yeah, Mrs. Moore, one of the things that struck me about the story that you tell about your own family and the others that you chronicle in the book is your ability to cultivate hope in situations that could, on the surface, seem hopeless. I mean, you and Wes, like any mother and son, knocked heads about a whole lot of things. Wes was not a fan of going to military school, for example. He was not a fan of doing a whole lot of things you thought he should do. And I think, as a son myself, I can tell you, been there, done that. But ultimately, cultivating hope, having people have a sense of a future that is brighter and has the potential to be brighter, that is a gift. And I think you certainly did that beautifully with your son. What's the secret sauce to that, to keeping hope alive, literally?
Well, I mean, I think that's probably the hardest thing that, especially a single mom, because sometimes, you know, I think when we don't have hope, we can't possibly transmit it to our kids to have hope. So that is something that we have to do personally. In fact, I write about it in one of the chapters in terms of, you know, making, you know, giving yourself the space and the environment to really say, okay, it may not be ideal at this moment, but I know that it can be better, and how can I get there? So once you do it for yourself, you can obviously give it to your child. If you don't give it to your, if you cannot do it for yourself, it's hard, you know, impossible to transmit that. So, you know, just looking at sort of the more positive things, okay, yeah, I don't have this, but I do have that. You know, I may be able to get something done if I can change this in my life. So, you know, I do think it's just really how we approach it as parents and as moms. In terms of what we can transmit, you know, to our kids.
Sure. I thought it was really prescient and acute to say in your book that you need to help children find their spiritual base even if you're reassessing your own. You know, I
absolutely.
Mean, self-doubt is
and
okay.
That, you know, as Wes said, I received that from my dad and from my mom, who's also, she was the first, you know, lady of the church. And so that's just something that we grew up with and, you know, was able to, you know, fortunately, I think one of the smartest things I did, despite my own anxiety about returning home, because kids are not supposed to be returning home, especially with three little kids, you know.
Because when your husband died, you moved back in with
I was able to get over that and realizing that this was a positive, because they would then grow up in the same spiritually filled home that I did. So even though I was angry, I will admit, I was angry. I tried to make a deal with God when before I knew that my husband actually, you know, had died, that, you know, if he would just let him live, I would do anything, you know, stop smoking, I would do anything I could. And when that failed me, then I felt that religion failed me. And it took a while to get back there, but I knew that my kids needed that spiritual base.
Yeah, you
and,
quote.
My parents were able to provide it until I was able to provide it myself.
You quote the physicist Edward Teller, who said, "Faith is knowing that one of two things will happen. Either you will be given something solid to stand on, or you will be taught how to fly." And Westmore,
yes.
you got taught how to fly. You learned how to fly, figuratively and literally. So, you know,
I absolutely did. And one of the things I loved about, you know, doing the book is doing all of this research to find these quotes that, because a lot of times, you know, single moms don't have, you know, I'm not even going to say single moms only. It's parents don't have a lot of time to read and, you know, sit down cover to cover. So, you know, what were the quotes? What are the things that you can sort of fall back on to provide that spiritual, that uplift that you need at that moment? That's really quick. And Teller was one of the ones that I picked. And there are just a host of others throughout the book.
We are running out of time. We have a caller whose call I'm not going to be able to get to. But Eliza Westmore wants to ask. She says, "I live in Baltimore. And what are the things we can do besides writing a check? What are the other things that we can do and should do to help?"
Yeah, I think that, you know, find that issue that you know makes your heart beat a little bit faster. You know, whether that is veterans issues, whether that is homelessness, whether that is, you know, young people, whether that is seniors, whatever that thing is, find that thing that you know you would give anything to try to solve. Then finding the organizations that are doing really good work in that space. If there's one thing about Baltimore, we have some great organizations and great social entrepreneurs in the city who would love your support, not even just your financial support, but just your time, your insight, your thoughts, and your knowledge about it. That, I think, will be an important first step. I think the second thing that people can do is get engaged about what are the policies and the structures that are making that thing even necessary. You know, Dr. King once said a quote where he said, "Philanthropy is commendable, but the philanthropist can never forget the economic injustice that makes philanthropy necessary."
Yeah.
And part of the thing that we can all do is find that thing that we know there's a structure that we can deal with and make your voice heard. Your power is not just in your purse. Your power is in your voice.
Well, Westmore, I very much appreciate your time. And Mrs. Moore, Joy Thomas Moore, you and your new book, The Power of Presence, Be a Voice in Your Child's Ear, Even When You're Not With Them. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Westmore is a best-selling author and the CEO of the New York-based Robin Hood. He is giving a talk tonight at the Parkway Theater. That's a benefit for WYPR. That event is sold out, but you can always hear Wes on the third Wednesday of every month on Future City, which airs right after midday and again at 9 o'clock. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Maryland Democratic Party Chair Kathleen Matthews is being challenged for the leadership of the state Democratic Party by Maya Rocky Moore Cummings. They will both join me here in Studio A tomorrow to talk about the future of the Democratic Party in Maryland and beyond. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review the new production of Elf, the musical, at the Olney Theater Center. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, they're offering an Indian cuisine class. You can find more on the web at baltimorechefshop.com. Before we go, a shout out to our colleague Dominique Maria Bonessi. She's done a terrific job covering City Hall and other beats for the WYPR News Department for the past 18 months. Today is her last day here at WYPR. She is moving on to a new reporting gig. So good luck, Dominique. And thanks. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks to you, too, for listening. Appreciate it. Have a great day.